Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 43, dropping October 3rd for our October 4th release of the issue of JBJS. The title of this episode is Shandy and ChatGPT to Inform Your Joint Practice. We'll get to that in a second. We are here, and as always, the opinions that you're going to hear are mine and Antonia's and not that of the JBJS editorial board, the other editors of the constituent journals, or the board of trustees. This episode is brought to you by the Miller Review Course 1 and 2. This is a combo message for both courses. It's that time of the year again. And Miller's orthopedic review courses remain dedicated to offering top-tier courses to physicians on their journeys to becoming board-certified orthopedic surgeons. An unmatched, unparalleled, really, ABOS exam prep experience is led by dedicated faculty. Don't leave your future to chance. Prepare for success. And the countdown has begun now. Your story starts here. Learn from legends, including Dr. Miller himself. Sign up for the courses. They're May 22nd to 26th for the part one and May 18th for part two, virtual or in person, Denver, Colorado. So definitely check that out. You may be wondering or asking, you know, who's Shandy? What's this Shandy about? For those who may be interested or know Kiss, the band Kiss, you know, they used to have makeup, they used 70s rock band, Hall of Fame rock legends. They recorded their song Shandy, and then after that, they took the makeup off, and that was like they sort of pivoted. So this is a memorialization, and I think we're going to break the rule right off the bat because, like, I think the next episode is technically our Halloween episode, but there are going to be some changes. Nothing about the format that you love or the content that we're providing or how we're covering it, but more, you know, the title's a little bit more straightforward, everyone understanding sort of what they're getting within each issue. We'll still be doing the Easter eggs now and again. I don't think we're going to let that go. You'll still hear about Kaiser Soze every now and then. But I think, you know, some of this is going to be more straight up than maybe it has in the past.
So we're taking our makeup off?
Yeah, we're taking our makeup off.
The makeup's going, guys. It's getting real.
All right. Let's
until Halloween.
You should introduce yourself.
I'm Antonia Chen, deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. And as a warning, Halloween's around the corner. So we'll put the mask on again, but yes, then take it off again.
That's right. That's right. So it, definitely by the November issue, I'm Larry David, deputy editor. No, I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And that's enough joking around already. Let's get into top of the pile. So we have in this special issue for you, Congenital Upper Limb Differences, a six-year literature review by Shah, Teach Me Orthopedics. Everyone can learn some orthopedics by Upal. This is permanently free, so no excuse on your opportunity to learn me orthopedics. What factors are associated with clinical trial discontinuation in orthopedic surgery? An analysis of clinical trials between 2007 and 2022 by Hecht. And then the AOA Critical Issues Symposium, Leadership and Education During and After COVID-19, Back to the Future or a New Normal by Plancher. So when you get the opportunity, check in on those articles. We're now going to move into the headlines. This is mine, Treatment of Symptomatic Residual Deformity in Leg Calvae Perthes Disease, Midterm Outcomes and Predictors of Failure After Surgical Hip Dislocation with Femoral Head Reshaping and Relative Neck Lengthening. It's quite a title. Novace and colleagues, it is 30 days free. This is a very interesting article conducted at Boston Children's, one of those types of articles that we've covered in the past that you can only really do when you have sort of this population that, in this case, I think it's really based on the experience and the expertise of the surgeons who are working in this space and the dedication of their patients that they continue to come back years and years and years after the procedure. So you get these relatively very long outlook on the intervention. And so these are patients who were operated between 2001 and 2013, symptomatic hips after healed LCP And this is a retrospective study to evaluate clinical and radiographic outcomes. They're looking at survival. They're doing a Cox proportional hazard regression, but they're also doing some Western Ontario and McMaster University's osteoarthritis index pain scores. So they're looking at survival. They're looking at some patient-centered outcomes. It's a relatively limited number of patients. There are only 60 patients. And 20 of these met the one of their endpoint criteria for surgical failure. So right off the bat there, you have concerns for an expertise bias, maybe a surveillance bias, reporting bias, and then restricted clinical variation. But there's still some very interesting findings. They estimated survival at 80% at 5 years and 66% at 10 years. Some of the concerns around that, the confidence intervals are a little bit wide. For the 5 years, it's 70 to 90%. For the 10 years, it's 53 to 81%. That's quite a big difference. You know, you're bordering on just 50% survival on the lower bound at 10 years. And then factors associated with surgical failure were severity of preoperative pain as assessed by the WOMAC pain score and the severity of deformity as assessed by the anteroposterior alpha angle. Definitely useful, statistically significant, but the clinical relevance is somewhat questionable. We're talking about a 16% increase in the hazard on the WOMAC score with a null or a borderline null finding for the lower bound at 1.03, much smaller value, 1.06 for the alpha angle. And I do recognize that these are, you know, meant to be incremental estimates. But again, with that restricted clinical variation, it's not necessarily going to pan out that, you know, five times or, you know, 5 point increase is going to equal five times the estimated hazard. And then the confidence intervals also will continue to widen. So there's some concern for imprecision that way. That said, I do think they're realistic about the findings. This is a difficult population to both capture and certainly model outcomes for. It is interesting work. It's work that's done by some real experts in the field. So that's also another consideration around the potential for expertise bias. But some valuable insights, some useful information in informing patient care. It is 30 days free. So definitely check that out. And then now you can tell me about your headline.
Well, I just want to say this is a pretty good sized population for, you know, what you have. It's a specialized hospital. So
right. It
is one of those things that it's not going to be able to get, you know, 60 doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot for the
60 patients with 10 to 20 year follow-up.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
All right. Mine is looking at the use of beta blockers and the risk of undergoing a knee arthroplasty, a nested case control study. This is by Tamini et al. I am going to touch on you, Andrew, and ask you about nested case control because you are the expert in these methodologies.
That's why I get paid the big bucks.
That's right. Yep. Dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
So beta blockers have been found to have a potential inhibitory effect on the OA degenerative process through the downregulation of several inflammatory mediators. And these are the ones that are really integrated in joint degradation, such as interleukin-1, tumor necrosis factor, and matrix metalloproteinases. All of these are which, you know, cause destruction of cartilage, leading to increased risk of osteoarthritis. So the hypothesis is that taking beta blockers may potentially decrease cartilage degradation and delay the progression of osteoarthritis. So the authors took a very large single institutional database, and they looked at patients who had a history of new onset knee pain between January 1st, 2020, sorry, 2010, and December 31st, 2019. So a 9 year span, essentially. And their endpoint was total knee arthroplasty. So they looked at comorbidities and they listed a whole bunch of different comorbidities that were associated. And they did talk about the ones associated with beta blockers. They also listed exclusions, of which the exclusion, they didn't say weight-bearing radiographs, but in another part of the paper, they did say that they should they excluded those that didn't have weight-bearing radiographs because Kellgren-Lawrence grade was used as part of the study. And they used a nested case control. So what did they say? They said the case group was a group of patients who underwent total knee arthroplasty. And what happens is that they had new onset knee pain within the trial period of 2010 to 2019, but they underwent a total knee replacement between January 1st, 2018 and December 31st, 2019. So a little bit of overlap, but not overlap over the entire period, which was interesting. I thought they would include total knee arthroplasty patients throughout the entire period. And secondly, the control group was actually the patients who had OA with beta blockers, and they compared them. So group one got a total knee arthroplasty, and group two, they looked about whether or not they got arthroplasty. Now, if I were designing the study personally, I would probably say look at all OA patients within a time frame and see who had beta blockers, who didn't have beta blockers for whatever reason, selective, non-selective, et cetera, and then compare the two groups to see who ended up with a total knee arthroplasty, understanding that's obviously a very big, wide range of individuals of why people go to total knee arthroplasty. And the other thing I would have said in this study too that would have been really helpful is to add radiographic data. So the benefit of having a single institution database is like, oh, okay, we have radiographic data. They matched patients by radiographic levels. We know 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, understandably from Kellgren-Lawrence grade, because you don't want to compare someone who has a Kellgren-Lawrence grade of 0 to one who has a Kellgren-Lawrence grade of 4. But by doing so, you don't know if there's actually cartilage or degradation or progression, right? So the loss of cartilage over time. So that same patient could have come in 2010 and come back in again in 2018, and they could have seen the cartilage degradation and see whether or not they had had beta blockers on board or didn't have beta blockers on board. So they did do that as part of the matching criteria, date of birth, plus or minus 2 years, sex, calendar time, from the first patient visit to the outpatient, the first visit to the outpatient clinic, and the grade of osteoarthritis. So the next step for the beta blocker, actually, I'm going to pause. I'm going to ask you about the methodology, and then I'll talk about the findings.
Okay.
Or do you want to keep going?
No, that's fine.
All right.
So in terms of the methodology, I think that it is reasonable, but also at the same time, the points that you raise are definitely valid. They're working with retrospective data, so they're limited in whatever the data set may have and what they can capture, what they can characterize. It's a lot of patients, so that gives them some, power. There isn't necessarily a problem with the nested aspects or things like that, and their matching does seem very reasonable. At the end of the day, all this can do is really speak to associations. It cannot speak to what you're getting at is that causation is not right. There's correlations. There's not causation here. And there can be a lot of reasons that individuals who may be prone to using beta blockers or prefer beta blockers or are really responsible about taking the beta blockers and other aspects that then provide some protective features for now. With what you're describing, you're going to reduce that. You need those patients with those multiple touch points with the appropriate characterization of each data element at that point and the imaging at that point. And you're going to that's going to shrink the power of the study quite substantially. So I suspect that's why they did what they did in the way that they did it. But for the readers, everything that's being presented here should be considered hypothesis generating and not necessarily clinically actionable. We would say it's an interesting idea, but there's nothing, when people present this or talk about this, they may say this demonstrates, this proves, they use this very strong language and conversating around the meaning of this work. And that's not the case.
As you saw, that's exactly my take home message, is that giving beta blockers does not necessarily prevent you from going to total knee arthroplasty. But the findings of the study, they did look at and say adherence was monitored during the follow-up period. And they're talking about adherence to beta blockers. They estimated by this proportion of days covered. So it's a ratio in which the numerator was the number of days covered by the pharmacy supplied medication, and the denominator was a 2-year period before the index date. Now, whether or not the patients actually took the medication, we don't know. But if the pharmacy supplied medication, assuming they took it during the duration that they had the medication over the 2 years, then that's how they defined that. Less than a quarter, between a quarter and 3/4, and greater than 3/4 was their adherence. And they looked at the cumulative effect of beta blockers as defined as the sum of the years of treatment, regardless of whether they were continuous or interrupted, with the use of the following category of variables: less than a year, 1 to 5 years, and greater than 5 years. Interestingly enough, they excluded a high number of patients, almost 50% of them. And they found that, that the non-selective beta blockers were associated with a lower likelihood of undergoing total knee arthroplasty with decreased total knee arthroplasty with increased proportion of days covered by a beta blocker. So for example, patients who were treated for a prolonged period of time, greater than 5 years, were at lower likelihood of undergoing total knee arthroplasty. But this was not true if they included not just beta blockers, but they also looked at the intake of opioids, NSAIDs, metamizole, and paracetamol or Tylenol. So interestingly enough, the other medications that people take to try to mitigate the pain associated with arthritis resulted in a higher likelihood of undergoing total knee arthroplasty, really pointing to the fact that these findings truly are not causative, right? It's not that beta blockers alone will cause someone to not undergo total knee arthroplasty, but there were correlations found in their study.
Unintended Easter egg here, but I just thought of it. In the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Indiana Jones has a sun disc and it's supposed to tell him how high the staff of Ra is supposed to be. And the guy is like, it says this on this side, but if you turn it on the other side, it says you have to take away two kadam, right? That's how many times I've watched that. I can almost quote it. But so, you know, in interpreting this, there is, you know, a point that is some cause for concern. And that's in their use of the cumulative effect of the beta blockers. They have a significant finding with 95% confidence intervals indicating significance for less than 1 year and for greater than 5 years, but not for the in-between 1 to 5 years, because the confidence interval there overlaps 1.0. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't, because the point estimates does indicate, but then the point estimates are also a little bit screwy. What you want to see in these kinds of things ideally is a dose response effect. So you start at 0.41 and you end at 0.36, and in the middle you have 0.52. So it goes up, then it goes down. It doesn't
correlate well.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's an interesting finding. It raises some hypotheses, you know, might promote further research. And I think that there's value in that. But if you're going to like invest in this and say, absolutely, beta blockers, you know, miracle drugs, that, no, I don't think so.
Perfect. Well, tell me now about ChatGPT and assessing ChatGPT responses to common patient questions regarding total hip arthroplasty.
Yes. So this is by Mika and colleagues. There is an infographic. I think you've heard in some previous episodes, you know, we've touched on AI quite a bit in the last few months. It's obviously a very hot topic. And here in this investigation, these authors basically wrote to ChatGPT, and they identified 10 frequently asked questions from various websites on total hip arthroplasty. And then they prompted ChatGPT to give them responses. And then they graded those responses in terms of how appropriate they were. Now, the first thing that I would say is that, you know, ChatGPT is super hot right now. If this was assessing Yahoo's responses or AOL's responses to common patient questions, I don't know that it would be considered that exciting. But that's essentially what this is. It's just like we asked the internet, you know, about these total hip questions. The other problem with ChatGPT is that every time you prompt it, it'll give you something slightly different. And that's a problem for reproducibility, fidelity, and translational capacity, because these were the answers that these individuals receive to these questions. But if you ask ChatGPT the questions right now, you might get slightly different answers. And it's constantly evolving, because the ChatGPT is pulling from the collective universe of published work. And as that expands, so does ChatGPT's ability to answer those questions. I think that's particularly exemplified by one of their responses, where it was asking about length of stay, and it said like 2 to 5 days, which is really not accurate.
Well, so it's even worse, I would say. The question that they asked was, how long does hip replacement surgery take? So they didn't even ask, how long do I stay in the hospital? But to ask, how long does hip replacement surgery take? So ChatGPT took the liberty to answer.
It answered both. It answered the question, hip replacement takes about 1 to 2 hours.
Right.
And then it gave you, and then it expanded.
And it gave you unnecessary information.
It turned into the Terminator. And we said we were going to stop, but obviously I can't stop. I thought I told you that we won't stop.
Won't stop, can't stop.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you got Terminator, you got Raiders of the Lost Ark now. All right. Before they pull the plug on us. You know, the other thing that bothers me is they treat ChatGPT like it's a person. They are constantly like, the chatbot correctly written. No, the chatbot didn't do anything. This is not a thing. It didn't come up with this. And it's literally just sort of like when you ask Siri, and Siri's like, I found this article that might be helpful. That's what this is doing, except it's just presenting it in a way where it makes it seem like you're having a conversation with the person. You want to go for three? It's like Zoltar from Big. Your wish has been granted. Like, you know, it's really just a machine. It doesn't have magical properties, no magical powers. You know, and then there's a lot of bias baked in here, because, you know, they decided what was satisfactory or what wasn't unsatisfactory. They didn't really spell out what's the threshold for what really was a good response or not. And there was one unsatisfactory. So for me, the machine only got it 90% right. That's not good for a machine, right? Like, it should be like 99.99999% right. That's the threshold for like the machine is excelling, not 9 out of 10. And then
that's an Asian F, by the way. In my culture, if you got a 90%, you were done.
So it talks about including the evolving nature of ChatGPT and similar programs. The responses given were subjective. It could be debated. Present findings suggest that AI-based platforms may serve as a useful supplement to informed and shared decision-making. I don't think, I mean, that's all just kind of narrative. Like, I could just say, this isn't useful at all, really. It doesn't answer the question in a way that certainly could replace a physician, and which it never should. I mean, that premise is just a non-starter as far as I'm concerned from Go. And, you know, the rubric, the response accuracy score, which is basically an ordinal scale of 1 to 4 from excellent to unsatisfactory. I think that you can just kind of say everything is set, like it's really just so subjective.
So it's our opinion versus the bot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just like this is our opinion that this is going on hold. I think it's going on hold.
On hold.
Yeah.
It's hold. Decision on hold.
So now on to the honorable mentions. We have long-term follow-up, 14 to 25 years following closed reduction and early movement for simple dislocation of the elbow. This is a study of 71 patients by McKinnon and colleagues. There is a commentary and a visual summary, and it's permanently free, the trifecta. As I mentioned, 71 patients, it's from original cohort, participating in kind of this new follow-on study, still graded level 4 appropriately, looking at patients that they tried to contact, follow-up patients from an original study group, looking at longer-term outcomes. And this shows original excellent outcomes following treatment with a short period of splinting, and early movement remained excellent and maintained into the very long term, which I think is useful for informing treatment. Then we have NAMPT, improved mitochondrial function, alleviates degenerative rotator cuff tendinopathy in aged mice by Zhang and colleagues. There's also a commentary for this. This is a basic science study assigning mice to different NAMPT-treated groups. And then they underwent subacromial injection with NAMPT-loaded fibrin gel, with control groups injected with fibrin gel alone. They found that the spontaneously developed degenerative rotator cuff tears in aged mice mimicked the clinical situation in elderly patients. It's kind of a proof of concept. They say that this confirms spontaneous development of degenerative RCT, rotator cuff tears in aged mice, and this will facilitate future studies of this condition. The results also suggest that this offers a novel therapeutic approach. So both confirming something to facilitate further testing, and then also suggesting a possible treatment protocol. Next, we have anatomic assessment of L1 to S1 neuroforaminal dimensions using computed tomography by Haryanja and colleagues. This is an anatomic study looking at CTs of 300 female and 300 male subjects between 18 and 35 years of age. The study describes CT-based neuroforaminal dimensions in these young, healthy patients. These were individuals who presented for reasons other than back pain, and they looked at the impact of sex and ethnicity on these dimensions. So a useful anatomic anthropometric study. And then we have the work of Ren and colleagues, debridement reconstruction docking management system versus Elizarov technique for lower extremity osteomyelitis. This study is a retrospective cohort of 289 patients who either underwent the debridement reconstruction docking or the Elizarov technique for lower extremity osteomyelitis between 2013 and 2021. They consider it a balanced retrospective cohort. The use of the docking system was associated with a reduced rate of infection recurrence and better functional results. So that's about it. Or these always go faster than you imagine that they will. We're about out of time. We'll try to do better next time. Hopefully your case is ready to go. But if you're in our world, your case is always on hold.
Enjoy.